Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 13, Text 10, Translation and Commentary by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada.
Eta Bhaktyatma Jai Vira Kayahya Pachitir Guru Shatya Pramatai Grihyetya Grihyetya Sadarangata Matsarahi Etavatyatma Jayavira Karyahya Pachitir Guru Shatya Pramattai Grihyeta Sadarangata Matsarahi.
This is Brahma speaking to Manu, Swayambhu Manu, after Manu has agreed to Brahma's order that Swayambhu Manu create project. So, translation. O hero, your example is quite befitting a son in relationship with his father. This sort of adoration for the superior is required. One who is beyond the limit of envy and who is sane accepts the order of his father with great delight and executes it to his full capacity. Purport. When the four previous sons of Brahma, the sages Sanaka, Sanatana, Sanandana, and Sanat Kumar, refused to obey their father, Brahma was mortified and his anger was manifested in the shape of Rudra. That incident was not forgotten by Brahma, and therefore the obedience of Manu, Swayambhuva, was very encouraging. From the material point of view, the four sages' disobedience to the order of their father was certainly abominable. But because such disobedience was for a higher purpose, they were free from the reaction of disobedience. Those who disobey their fathers on material grounds, however, are surely subjected to disciplinary reaction for such disobedience. Manu's obedience to his father on material grounds was certainly free from envy, and in the material world it is imperative for ordinary men to follow the example of Manu. Brahma is congratulating Swayambhuva Manu for accepting his order. Maybe he was afraid that Manu would also disagree. In this way, if all of the... generally the younger brothers follow the example of the older brothers, so I'm told. I didn't have any brothers this lifetime round, but I'm told that. So if all of the... he kept on mentally creating sons, and they all refused to accept his order to populate the universe, then his service, Brahma's service to the Supreme Lord would be impeded. That was part of his service. Brahma is known as Prajapati, one of the meanings of which is... patriarch is one meaning, and progenitor. So he's very pleased that Swayambhuva Manu accepted his order, and indirectly, while praising Manu, he's also censuring the four Kumaras by saying to Manu that one who is beyond the limit of envy and who is sane accepts the order of his father. Indirectly, he's saying that the Kumaras, by disobeying his order, were envious and not same. Actually, the word used here is guru unto the superiors, which contextually here means the father. So Srila Prabhupada has translated that as father. But Brahma, he is, being such a great personality, he is more than an ordinary father. Of course, the father is to be considered a guru, and within the broader definition of the term guru, certainly the father is guru. Sometimes in Shastra where it said, refers to gurus, it means the elders among whom the father is the most important. So the father is one kind of guru. And the point that's being made here is that one should follow the instruction of the guru, which makes sense because there's no point in accepting a guru if one is not prepared to follow the instruction. One voluntarily submits oneself to a guru, and one is the, having voluntarily submitted oneself, one voluntarily submits oneself to give up all other voluntary actions. That's your last voluntary action. Of course, it doesn't mean that you become a complete straight-jacketed, mentally and physically straight-jacketed zombie. But it means that one should act according to the direction of the guru. That means the guru may give, or must give, room to move, but according to certain guidelines. The position with the father is a little different, because you don't choose your father. Still, it's expected that one obey the father, because the father is a guru in the sense that he's superior, and he's supposed to instruct the children, and he's supposed to know better than the children, and he instructs the children for the children's own welfare. So he should be accepted as a guru. Now, here is referred to a case of where the children thought that they knew better than the father, which is a common syndrome in the modern world. But actually in this case, the children were correct. Because Brahma, he is in service to the Supreme Lord, taking the post of Brahma. And he certainly has a very important spiritual function as the head of one of the four Vaishnav Sampradayas in the world. Also, the particular Brahma who is overseeing the universe at the present time is a pure devotee of Krishna. Not all of them are, but they're exceptionally pious persons. That is the minimum qualification to become Brahma. But his main service in the world as Brahma is a material function. It's in the service of Krishna, so it's not material in the sense that the activities of a demoniac person are material. But he has to create the universe each day, each day of his life. And he has to fill it up with living beings and give a general overseeing. He doesn't get much involved in the day-to-day activities. Whatever you mean by day-to-day, if you're talking about Lord Brahma, his day is different to other people's days, and the demigods' days are different to the human days on this planet, but he doesn't get so much involved. He's something like the God who's, it's sometimes postulated that God created the universe and then let it go on its own way. So Brahma is something like that, although he does get involved time to time. So the Kumaras, they weren't interested in any material function whatsoever, and so when Brahma ordered them to create progeny, they disobeyed. They said, no, we're just going to execute spiritual activities. So they were right, in that sense, to disobey the order of their father, because the highest function of any living being is to pursue spiritual life. So the Kumaras, they were right, but nevertheless, Brahma, he didn't see it like that. He became angry, and out of his anger, Rudra became manifested. So he's remembering this now, in the case of Swayambhuva Manu, who followed his instruction. Both Manu and the Kumaras are greatly elevated persons. They're both counted among the 12 Mahajans. So it's not that the Kumaras were wrong for disobeying, or that they're, or that they were so much right that and Manu was wrong. If the Kumaras were right, and then Manu must have been wrong to obey Brahma's order. But the Kumaras were right, and Manu was right. They both pursued spiritual life in different ways. The Kumaras didn't accept Brahma as their spiritual authority, and they also became the heads of one sampradaya. So, even though they disobeyed their guru, they were highly elevated spiritually, and Srila Prabhupada mentions this, that their disobedience was for a higher purpose. Therefore, they were free from the reaction of disobedience. So it may happen that a guru who expects obedience from his disciples, he may not always get it. We see this at the very highest level. And we see it quite often in the modern age also. Now, here's an example from what we would consider ancient times. In more recent times, well, there's the very famous example of Ramanuja Acharya, who, how many times? 17 times he was refused initiation. And then he was given it, and he was taught, initiation means to be given the mantra. And he was told that this mantra gives liberation, don't tell it to anyone. So after being refused again and again and again, he finally got the initiation, got the mantra on these grounds, and immediately he broke that injunction. Hearing which, his guru told him, then you'll have to go to hell. Okay, I'll go to hell. But everyone else will get liberated. So, that was Goshtipurna who initiated him. He was his mantra guru. More recently, we see in our own sampradaya, I've just been last couple of days going through Bhaktisiddhanta Vaibhava. It's a very enriching reading. Seeing some points, how Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur It seems that he wasn't fully in line with Bhaktivinoda Thakur or Srila Gorky Shodas, or Bhaktivinoda Thakur himself. It's a controversial point up to the present time and will probably remain so forever, because I don't think at this point it's possible to unravel the facts of what transpired between Bhaktivinoda Thakur's Diksha Guru, Bipin Bihari Goswami, and himself. And even if we were able to ascertain the facts in terms of what we consider to be facts, that is the historically true narration of who said what to who and all this kind of thing, but to understand the internal dealings is not possible. We can only guess at that. And it's better not to guess when we're dealing with great pure devotees. Vaishnava Kriya Mudra Bigehana Bhujoy. Those who are great Vaishnavas, we can, their activities and what they say and they do, simply by some great scholarship, we can't understand. So, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who didn't accept initiation for many years, he didn't see anyone qualified for that, he describes. But then Krishna arranged, in his own description, Bipin Bihari Goswami, who he'd been in contact with, came and, well, he sent a letter that, "I'm going to come and I'll initiate you." So Bhaktivinoda Thakur accepted that as great mercy. But later, it seems there was some tension or disagreement, though we won't find it in Bhaktivinoda Thakur's writings. It's widely said that Bipin Bihari Goswami used tobacco, but that doesn't seem to have been any grounds for Bhaktivinoda Thakur to have distance himself from him. But it seems that Bipin Bihari Goswami didn't like Bhaktivinoda Thakur, or maybe we can only speculate. He was under pressure from the other caste Goswamis in whose association he was, Bipin Bihari, that Bhaktivinoda Thakur was opposed to this monopoly on initiation that was claimed by the caste Goswamis, by many of them, not all of them. So that became an issue. And then Bhaktivinoda Thakur's declaring the birthplace of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to be in Mayapur. There was already a Mayapur on the other bank of the river. It's still there. Prachin Mayapur, they call it old Mayapur, ancient Mayapur. But Bhaktivinoda Thakur declared that this site, which we now know as Mayapur, and which is world famous as Mayapur, that's Mayapur. But the old school didn't like that. Significantly, Bhaktivinoda Thakur had that confirmed by Jagannath Das Babaji Maharaj, that the Gauravi Bhava Bhume Strang Nirdeshta Sajjana Priyaha Vaishnava Sarva Bhoma Sri Jagannathaya Te Nama. The pranam mantra for Sri Jagannath Das Babaji Maharaj, which was composed by Ananta Vasudeva Mahasaya, that is described there, that the place, the very place, which was Nirdishta, it was pointed out by Jagannath Das Babaji, he ascertained, this is it, that he is glorified for that. So there was some tension there between, it seems clear, although all the details are not clear, between Bipin Bihari Goswami, the initiating guru of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and between Certainly in Gaurya Matlain, which means us also. Bipin Bihari Goswami is not accepted as the substantial guru of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Although it's a controversial issue. But there was definitely some tension was there at some point. Between Bhaktivinoda Thakur and Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, Lalit Prasad Thakur, the one brother of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, who took spiritual life as his life's mission. He was fully dedicated to Krishna consciousness in a very different way. He accused that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was not following Bhaktivinoda. Bhaktivinoda Thakur's general approach was he pointed out clearly who's bona fide Vaishnava and who is not in his writings, but he, at the same time, he was very careful, it seems, not to make enemies in the field. He wanted to bring up Vaishnavism. So within the Vaishnava field, he tried not to make enemies, which meant that he also was friends, with Shishir Kumar Ghosh, who wrote two books, one in Bengali, Amiya Nimai Charit, and the other one called Lord Gauranga, which Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur says just a bunch of sentimentalism. But it to the present day, the Amiya Nimai Charit is considered a very inspiring work for people to get enlivened by the pastimes of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, although Shishir Kumar Ghosh was like most Bengalis, an inveterate fish eater. So Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he had a much more aggressive approach in combating who he saw as the enemies of Vaishnavism from within the camp of Vaishnavism. In his youth, of course, in traditional Indian culture, youth goes up till at least the age of 30. They're considered a boy. Srila Prabhupada used to speak of his disciples as boys and girls, which to the boys and girls seemed a little odd, because you speak of boys and girls up to about the age of 14 or 15. After that, you start speaking about young men and young women. But in Indian culture, boys and girls, it goes up to at least 30. They may be married, but they're still boys and girls. So in his youth, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, he was in Puri, living in Puri with Bhaktivinoda Thakur. This must have been about 1910, something like that. So he would have been early 30s in age, mid 30s maybe. So he was in Puri. The Nitai Gaur Radhe Sham cult was very strong. It still is, actually. They still go on, they're on Harinam around their ashram every day, or they go around the town. But they were very much appreciated, because actually they were doing something. They were attracting young, educated people, what Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur later did, but they were already attracting people of good class to become Vaishnavas, but Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was very much against them. And he was very aggressively against them, and he would catch people on the street and just start berating them. You know, this Nirayagaur Radhe Shyam, they're all bogus. And it was creating quite some disturbance. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur sent him away from Puri. But at the same time, it wasn't just that he banished him, but he sent him to oversee the affairs at Mayapur, which is in a shambles. Bhaktivinoda Thakur had started that temple in Mayapur, but it was just it was chaotic. There's no one there to oversee what was going on. So he sent him there. So in various ways, it may seem that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he was submissive to Bhaktivinoda Thakur in almost always, but he didn't like this family life. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he didn't like this, that they're getting married, having children and all this. He was like, in that sense, like the Kumaras. So there are a few comments of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur in this regard. So they were very different, and at some point there may have been some appearance of some tension between them. Gaurkishore Das Babaji Maharaj, he initiated Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. And later on, when Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was speaking at the samadhi of Gaurkishore Das Babaji Maharaj, this means obviously after Gaurkishore's disappearance. So, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, he said, my guru gave me three orders. One was to not make any disciples. Another was not to associate with anyone. And another was not to live in Calcutta, where he had established his preaching base. So he said that, so I followed all these orders. I never made any disciples. He was speaking to his disciples at this point. He said, because actually all my disciples, I have so much to learn to them about service to Krishna, so they're all my gurus. He said, I didn't associate with anyone, because association means to take something from someone, but I didn't take anything from anyone, only from my guru. And he said, I never went to Calcutta. I only stay in the Gauriya Math, which is Vaikuntha. So it appears that the guru wanted something of the disciple, which the disciple didn't follow. It could be said, as I noted in a footnote there, that it wasn't just sophistry on the part of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, that he was just making some word jugglery to get out of having disobeyed his guru's order. But he took as the central order from his guru the order that he'd got at the time of initiation, shortly after initiation, to preach the message of the six Goswamis, making that your life's central mission. So, taking that as the central order, then the other orders were harmonized in that. But Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur seemed to be not very much like his guru. And it appeared that he wasn't following the same ideal. He did at one point, he was living with him, but then later he became involved in accounts and looking after properties and having so many disciples. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur himself, it's reported that he had many disciples. Some he was very intimate personally with them, he trusted them very much, but then he felt, later on he felt that they had misused him, they had cheated him. So there are examples of great devotees who apparently disobey the order of their guru, are not completely in line with them. But the result is that Krishna's service is increased. So there's no disobedience on that platform. But then there are others who Srila Prabhupada writes in this purport, out of envy, that on the material platform they disobey. Now, naturally one accepts a guru and then one is supposed to follow his order. The idea is that he knows better than me. I require to follow his guidance. If I do so, then I will be benefited and Krishna will be pleased. Yasya prasadat bhagavat prasado, yasya prasada nagati katopi. So the point is not to disobey the guru, the point is to obey. And some instances are being related of very great devotees who are exceptional in as much as they appear to disobey their guru, but the result is laudable. The result is a great efflorescence, I've been reading Bhaktisiddhanta Vaibhava, of Krishna consciousness. One should, now I know I was about to say one should obey the order, disobey the order of the guru under certain, no, one shouldn't, but we see in the case of great souls who disobey the order of their guru that the result is not just some minor thing, but some very major contribution to the mission of the Lord in this world. The four Kumaras, they disobeyed Brahma's order, and in this way they didn't contribute to the mission of the Lord in this world of creating progeny, but then in another way they did, by becoming the interface for the Kumar Sampradaya. They became heads of a Vaishnava Sampradaya, so they did something very great for the service of Krishna. Now, much more common than this is those who disobey their guru on material grounds. And that is disastrous. If the disciple thinks that he knows better than the guru, he may think, well, my guru, he's very neophyte, but then if the disciple is also very neophyte, or maybe the guru is more elevated and the disciple is just some envious rascal, then the disciple gets in a lot of trouble. So it may be that one gets a guru in the same way as one gets a father, without much thinking about it or without much choice. For instance, it was usual in India up until a recent time that people got initiated, because in Shastra it says that if someone doesn't get initiated, they're just like an animal. You have to be initiated. So there were family gurus, and you didn't really think about it very much. Not at all. You just, the guru's there, and at a certain point in time, you get your, you get initiated, just like in the Catholic Church. You get baptized when they take you out of the hospital in 2 or 3 days, and then shortly after that they take you to church and pour some water on you, and the baby screams, and then he's saved from hell by having the priest pour some water over you, and then the priest goes back to his little house and eats his roast beef, and everyone's safe from going to hell. But when you're older, they have confirmation at the age of 12, in my case. And even at the time, I was thinking, well, not sure about this. But there was no real choice in the matter, because I didn't have the chutzpah or the guts to say no. I wasn't really thinking of no. It wasn't really so. It was just another formality. Okay, now you're 12 years old, so you go for your confirmation to confirm. Yes, I really want to be a Roman Catholic. It's called. I got baptized when I didn't have any choice, but now I'm old enough and I can make my own decision. But I wasn't. I was still a child, and I got confirmed, so to speak. Although later, when my mother wanted me to be a Catholic priest and to go to school for that, my father very clearly told me, you have to decide what you want. Do you want to go for this or not? And then I mustered up enough courage to say no. So I didn't end up as a Catholic priest. But most people traditionally, they just get a guru, just like they get a father and a mother. And for better or for worse, they don't have much choice in the matter. Srila Prabhupada also, he was initiated in his childhood by some. His father brought some guru, and would have been the family guru, and got initiated. But Srila Prabhupada, it seems, he never took that very seriously. He just mentioned it once, that's all. But the guru clearly wasn't an important figure in his life. Srila Prabhupada mentioned that his father, he would call sadhus daily and feed them. And for those who wanted, he would provide a hookah also. Hookah means with tobacco, probably. Maybe with ganja also, I don't know. Because many sadhus, they take ganja. Not only Shaivites, in Ramananda Sampradaya also. There's many of them who are fond of ganja. Although you wouldn't get so many Ramanandis, I guess, in Calcutta. Maybe because that area of Harrison Road, that's actually, although Prabhupada is from a Bengali family, but that's a Marwari area. And you get plenty of Biharis and all. At least in the 1970s, when I used to hang out in Calcutta, it was like that. Okay, so you may get a guru the same way you get a father. You don't really think about it. You just get initiated, because that's what you're supposed to do. And it may be like that in ISKCON also. You join in a particular center, and everyone there gets initiated by the same guru, and that's it. You don't really think about it much. You may not even know that according... You may not even be told that according to ISKCON law at the present time, you're supposed to know that there is a multi... There is choice of gurus, and you're supposed to join out of your own... You may not even know. But then what can happen... Now, of course, there are cases of gross fall down on the case of gurus, but there are also cases of gurus who don't grossly fall down. I'm talking about within ISKCON. But who after some time the disciple feels, well, not really sure about this one, if I really want to surrender. Because it's a big thing. You're supposed to surrender your life and be prepared to follow whatever is given. And guru traditionally is very demanding. Not the cooler gurus, because they're functional gurus. But one who's an actual guru, he's very demanding. So you may think, well, I don't like this one. It's too much. Or there may be gurus in ISKCON who are not very demanding, because, well, for whatever reason, they're not very demanding. Or, so it may be that after getting initiated, you may think, well, You may think this, my guru is not very demanding. I want a guru who is more demanding. That can also be. And it may be, we've seen in some instances, that people are attracted to take initiation from a certain guru and do so. And then that guru himself changes his attitude in Krishna consciousness in many ways, so that what you signed up for is no longer what you get. There are instances of that also, which can create tension or distance between gurus and disciples. And the guru may feel, well, my disciples should just follow me. And they say, oh, well. They don't feel inclined to do so. They perceive the teachings of the parampara through their guru as he was teachings. And now they see that the guru's outlook, attitude, and maybe teachings have in some ways significantly altered, and then their own understanding of Krishna consciousness is molded by what the guru used to teach and not by what he presently teaches. And so the disciples may just not go along, and in this way they become distant. There are some other instances also. I know of one godbrother of mine who, shortly after Srila Prabhupada left this world, this godbrother left ISKCON and took initiation from some Vaishnava outside of, in Bengal. He's from the West, but he was living in Bengal. So he said that, I felt I needed a guru, someone to guide me. And I didn't see anyone in ISKCON who I could look up to, a godbrother who I could look up to on that level. I felt I needed a personal guide to guide, although he actually left that guru also after some time. And we do find it's also been quite common that someone goes, they join ISKCON, and then they go to some Gauriya Math, and then they go to some Babaji. And they take one guru after another. I think we should be more careful before accepting initiation. The thing is that there's so much to understand that it's almost as if those who are in some ways ready to accept initiation, in as much as they're serious about Krishna consciousness, they're ready to follow, but they're not really mature enough to make such a decision as to who they should take initiation from. You really need to be practically on the level of a guru to understand to understand who you should approach. And what you want may be a factor also, because, like I said, people, you put your life under the guidance of a guru, but then we are individual living beings, and then what we want, and what is our aspiration? Are we inclined to a life of bhajan, or are we inclined to a life of active preaching, or are we Rama bhaktas or Dwaraka bhaktas or Vrindavan bhaktas? It may take some time to understand all this. Of course, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, although he himself was specifically came to taste the bliss that Radha tasted tastes in service to Krishna. But it's said about him that he came to preach Chari Bhav, the different approaches to Krishna. And within, among his followers, there were different kinds of devotees, mostly oriented toward Vrindavan, but there were also Rama Bhaktas, when he was in Sri Rangam, he discussed with Venkata Bhat and established that Krishna is sweeter than Narayan, but he didn't say to Venkata Bhat, now you have to become a Gauriya, although his Venkata's nephew, Gopal Bhatta, did become a Gauriya. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was very liberal in that regard, and it may be that a guru in the line of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu can accept all kinds of devotees who may later develop a specific propensity in the service of Krishna. We see that quite a few devotees in the Western world come to Krishna consciousness via ISKCON, and they gradually gravitate towards Sri Vaishnavism. And it may be that, which is in many ways a different bhav or a different feeling to that of Gauriya Vaishnava. So it may be that in their previous life they were like that. They have that specific feeling. So that's the case with some of my disciples from India, South India, either this life or previous life. They get inspired by ISKCON and Srila Prabhupada's teachings and followers, but later, having taken that inspiration, they feel more inclined to that Ramanuja Sampradaya line. So, from my side, well, okay. You can't dictate someone's spiritual inclination. There may be other issues also. I mean, apart from this more exalted considerations. Well, maybe there are more exalted. You find devotees who, you know, they really want to get into the Vrindavan bhav. And yeah, okay, but with that, I would say, be a little cautious. Don't jump into that too quickly. Vrindavan bhav, yes, but that Vrindavan vraja bhav, the very essence of that is selfless service. So that should be cultivated in the Sankirtan movement. Otherwise, it's very difficult to find proper guidance in this, because we see many, obviously very neophyte devotees who think themselves to be in Vrindavan bhav, but then from their behavior, we can understand that they're cultivating something which is, it's not on the platform of the soul, it's on the platform of the mind and the imagination. So cultivating that mood of Vrindavan, that has to be approached very, very carefully. We're not saying not to do so. In fact, that's what we're supposed to be doing. But we have to approach with some caution. Maybe in Sri Vaishnava line, if people gravitate toward that, well, you don't have to be so cautious, because there's so much caution inbuilt into the system anyway. It's the whole mood is one of a lot of caution. Now, yeah, apart from these exalted considerations, there are also less exalted considerations, just like, for instance, yeah, the one's guru, his understanding becomes that, well, we have to be much more open in our dealings, and so even though he's a sannyasi, he's very open in his dealings with women, and then the disciple may lose faith that he's properly representing. I'm not talking here, I have some specific case in mind of how there may be a tension between guru and disciple. And the guru, he feels offended by that. He thinks, well, I know what I'm doing, and why it's not the position of the guru to question me. And the disciple himself may feel like that, but then he just can't go on day after day, week after week, month after month, not questioning. And he himself doesn't, he feels very uncomfortable to get into that same kind of mood, because he feels it's outside his understanding of what Krishna consciousness should be. And he feels that for himself, it's, if he was to adopt such an attitude of being very open to all kinds of things that he's been close to, because he's trying to be Krishna conscious, he's trying to follow Asat Sangha Tyag, so he distances himself to a large extent from many of the bad influences of modern life. But then his guru, in the name of making Krishna consciousness more accessible, then he takes a different approach. So we can, in one sense, we can sympathize with the guru, and we can sympathize with the disciple also. That he, and then he feels that this is not conducive to my spiritual life, and it's not going to be conducive to anyone else's either. We're just watering things down, and then there, some tension comes, and there may be a rift between the guru and the disciple. So this may happen. We don't find that kind of problem in gurus who, well, especially in India, because the gurus who live in a very traditional way, if they, and they're just like guru, they don't get in, they just do what people expect the gurus to do. And I'm thinking of particularly Radha Govinda Maharaj, who's, he wears wooden shoes, he lives simply, he speaks on the Bhagavatam, he doesn't get involved in social issues or controversies, or even if he may say some controversial things, he doesn't pursue what you might call politics or any such thing, and he's just absorbed in the Bhagavatam, and he's just exactly what people would expect a guru to be. And so I don't know that his disciples have any difficulty with it. It's very easy for them just to accept him as a guru. And everything's clear as far as they're concerned. And like many traditional gurus, as far as I know, he doesn't push his disciples very much to do this or do that. Pushing is there in many gurus, and especially in our preaching line, Bhaktisthan Saraswati Thakur, Srila Prabhupada, they were very pushing. But traditionally, well, there may be some cases of gurus in an ashram and they're very strong with their disciples, but especially with householder disciples, it's not usually that they're pushing them to do this, that, or anything else. Although it is very different in the Western world, and preaching Krishna consciousness in a culture outside of India, where the whole concept of guru-disciple relationship is just something completely, I mean, it's just not there at all. Rather the opposite, that one should be anti-authoritarian is considered a good quality. Oh, another example from within our ISKCON experience is the many disciples of Kirtananda Swami, especially in Pakistan, who they heard all these things, oh, he did this, he did that, which isn't right, and they said, well, he's our guru. Once you've got a guru, that's it. You know, you can say what you like about him, but he's our guru. And Many of them are still doing very well in Krishna consciousness. They didn't follow his whole Christian thing, that didn't reach Pakistan. And they just followed all the basic stuff of Krishna consciousness, and they didn't adopt all that. So I don't think he even tried to export it to Pakistan. And they're doing okay. There's that sannyasi disciple of his in Rishikesh, who's running a temple, and it's just like an ISKCON temple, but his disciple of Bhaktipat. So he's not accepted. But they were able to take the essence without getting very mental about it. And so where is all this leading to? What's the conclusion? What is the conclusion? It's going to have to be different in different cases. It's hearing all this, someone might think, well, yeah, okay, now I got the this lecture is a justification to not follow your guru. But it's not. It's just discussing some of the difficulties that can arise. And it, for quite a few devotees in our movement, it is a reality that they're living with, and it can be very difficult for them. One should think that, well, you should be able to discuss. If the disciple himself is somewhat mature in Krishna consciousness, should be able to discuss with his guru about, I have this misunderstanding, I'm not clear about why you're doing this or that, or I just can't accept that you're doing this or you're doing that. But I don't know how many gurus would be willing to accept that. Especially when the injunction of Shastra is that one is to see the guru as good as God. Acharyam mam vijaniyam navamanyeta karhichit. Namartya buddhya suyeta sarvadeva maya guru. So the injunction is there to just accept guru as good as God, but one has to keep one's intelligence awake and see that, well, he may be as good as God, but I don't see God manifested through him in certain of his activities. And he may be as good as God, but I'm not, maybe due to my own weakness or whatever, I'm not getting God through him. So I have to make some adjustment. As it appears, Bhaktivinoda Thakur made some adjustment. The four Kumaras made some adjustment. They're very high devotees. We're very small devotees. It may be also that out of envy or out of material motivations, that's another big topic, how in someone's mind their material motivations mix with their spiritual aspirations. So they may want to be a devotee of Krishna, and they're serious about bhakti, but at the same time it mixes with desires to show that I'm doing so much for Krishna, I'm opening temples, I'm distributing books. So it mixes up with material desires. And then one may think that he's fit to instruct his guru. But to think, and in some ways one may be also. In some ways. Just like, well, on the material platform, just like, for instance, I may have some disciples who are doctors, so I may take some their advice on some medical condition, not that I'm the guru, and therefore whatever you learned in medical school, I know better because I'm the guru. Uh, The guru can take advice from the disciple, and it may be in various matters, even how to proceed with different plans for Krishna consciousness, opening centers, things like this. But if one thinks that now I am the advisor to the guru, then one becomes in a very dangerous situation. So Chanakya, he says that five people one should not become very close to. One is the guru. Should not become very close to. Generally we think we should become very close to the guru. But not very familiar with, he says. One is the guru, one is the king. Brahmana, I can't remember them all. But I remember the guru and the king. Because one should not become very familiar with, because they can do you great good and great harm also. Oh yeah, just one point, there's this. Actual rejection of the guru, that is also discussed in Shastra, but not on whimsical grounds. The grounds are there. Guru api avaliptasya karya karya janata. Upanna pratipannasya parityago vidhiyate. That one should fully reject the guru, even though he's guru, if he's not following properly, he doesn't know how to instruct properly, he was previously good but is now not proper, he's fallen down. So one should reject. And in Sri Krishna Bhajanamrita, this of Narahari Sarkar, he says that's also, it's like divorce in Islam. You can divorce, but not so quickly. In India they say talak, talak, talak. It's just one time the wife is cooking and all of a sudden the husband comes up and says talak, talak, talak. She's divorced without any prior notice. But apparently, according to the hadith, the laws derived from that, Shariat law, the husband has to say talak three times. Talak means divorce. So one time he says, then 6 months later he says, and then again 6 months after that, then she's divorced. Not that you say three times all at once. So Narahari Sarkar also says that even though Shastra says that one should reject the guru on certain grounds, but don't rush into it. First you have to spend some time and see if he's being corrected, or you may even yourself try to correct him on the basis of the instructions that he previously gave. So rejection of a guru is a very serious thing. But there may be some distance, there may be some not full surrender in the heart, not chitete kuriya guru mokha padma vakya chitete kuriya. If one gets a guru, and then I feel myself very fortunate in that regard, brahmanda brahmite kono bhagyavanji, very fortunate. If one finds a guru who one can fully surrender to, that may be difficult. If you see Srila Prabhupada, it's so many, a huge, vast body of words that he said. Even one book Tamal Krishna wrote, he said, it's almost as if Prabhupada gave too much, because there's so much, it's almost impossible, it's difficult to... there's so much, it's like almost... I can't remember exactly what he said. It's like, there's so much, it's difficult to analyze it all and get a hold of it all, but there may be things which devotees find difficult to understand and accept. But that doesn't mean that one doesn't accept. One's spirit should be to accept. And even if one doesn't understand something fully, well, anyway, you have to accept with the idea that I what do I know? I'm just nothing. So, something else I was going to say. No, it just came in my mind and left my mind. So, oh yeah. Yeah, someone recently came to see me last time I was in Bangalore and was saying some statements of Srila Prabhupada about some of his godbrothers, about one of his godbrothers in particular, which it's recorded, it's there in the conversations book. But from the point of facticity, it's not true. And what do we make of this? And he asked me, because he is a follower of that, disciplic follower of that godbrother. And naturally they feel very offended, because what Prabhupada said was not at all complimentary. And I said that, I told him, I don't understand. It's clear, there's no question that it's not true. But on the other hand, he's not here to ask about that now. And I'm not going around publicizing it everywhere, but on the other hand, I can't reject or not accept his teachings. And you also, you should see the great good that he's done to the world, and not get hung up on some obscure statement which he spoke actually in private to a few of his disciples, which was later published. I don't understand it. That's all. That doesn't mean that I feel that Srila Prabhupada is not Krishna's representative, or that I doubt everything else that he says. But it does open up some questions if you want to probe very deeply. How deeply do you probe? Our Western mentality of wanting to understand everything down to the nittiest, grittiest detail. Some things maybe we should just leave. But then you might not be able to also. Just like if these followers, if they keep on pushing and making an issue of it, then we may, what reply do we give to them? This is why one of my godbrothers, he said that he thinks that Prabhupada's conversation shouldn't have been published. All of them should have been edited first. He said his wife, who's also a very good devotee, god sister of mine, she was very disturbed when she saw some of the things that Srila Prabhupada said about women. Although it's in his books also. But maybe the more frank way in which Srila Prabhupada said it in his conversations. So, anyway, these some points for thought. The world is not in our control. The books are published. People will criticize also. Srila Prabhupada is being criticized as a, in many ways, as being for his being racist, sexist, and so many things. Some points are very, very sensitive. Very sensitive. Yeah, so I probably gave more questions than answers in that little talk. Hare Krishna. Anything? Hare Krishna. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada ki jai.